Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Harry Rosenfeld has just penned a memoir of life as a newspaperman, from Kristallnacht to Watergate. Rosenfeld is editor-at-large, an editorial board member, and a consultant at the Times Union in Albany, where he previously was editor. Before that, he was metro editor at the Washington Post, where he managed reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and their Watergate investigation that earned the newspaper a Pulitzer Gold Medal for public service. Jack Warden played him in the movie. Born in Berlin, Rosenfeld was a child when Kristallnacht occurred in November of 1938. He saw his synagogue burned and Jewish-owned businesses destroyed. The shattering of their glass windows gave the pogrom its name. Weeks before, his father was seized by the Gestapo. Once reunited, the family fled to the United States in 1939. In his memoir, Rosenfeld traces his interest in journalism and the importance of holding government accountable to those events in his early life. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Harry Rosenfeld to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
At what point did you start toying with the idea of a memoir?
Some years ago, I thought, because of my own lack of understanding of my past, that is to say, how my parents grew up and their background, I thought that I should spare my children and grandchildren the same experience. So I began to think about writing a family history. And somewhere along that line, that expanded. Well, in writing my history, it was writing about my career as an editor. So out of that evolved the memoir.
Do you quite understand, and it seems like this book is a bit of an exploration of this question, which is how you became what you became. Do you understand how those early influences shaped your life as a journalist, as an editor?
I understand that a lot better today than I understood it at the time I became a journalist, especially from the point of view of my retirement. I was able to focus on that, and thinking about my own history, I was able to make connections that in my mind always existed but were not clearly recognized by me. I, for example, have come to conclude that there was a reason I didn't go into my father's fur business or into trade generally, and that was tied exactly to my upbringing in Nazi Germany, where the Hitler regime, the only thing good they had to say about the Jews was that they were good at business. And so I must have internalized that caricature, that stereotype, and I shied away from the idea of going into business. But by the time I graduated high school, I already knew that I wasn't destined for anything else but journalism.
As the title indicates, from Kristallnacht to Watergate, that experience in Nazi Germany forever shapes you, right? I mean, that's
inescapable, I think.
Right.
It's just too traumatic.
The trauma is immediate and something that I assume you always look at and always returns, but also at some point becomes a fabric of which to build on.
Hard to say whether it becomes a fabric. Positively, it has been part of my thinking for a long time, and especially since I've given up the focus of editing daily newspaper and being reflective about myself and my life. It is very much a part of me, and recognizing now, as I of course could not at the time, that Kristallnacht was really the prelude to the Holocaust. It was the line when the Nazis crossed that was the line that permitted them to cross many more terrible lines. But that understanding and recognition didn't come to me until I had set time to sit down and think about it. While I was working, I thought about how to put out the best newspaper I knew how.
Right. when your family finally was able to leave and flee to the United States, how old were you, and how much of that do you actively remember?
I was 9 when we left Germany. On the way to becoming 10, it was May. I turned 10 in August. I remember everything I write in the book. I either remember myself or my sister has told me, my older sister, she's 8.5 years older, and obviously has a better store of that kind of information than I possibly could. But most of it is I remember vividly myself. I remember vividly, down to the smallest detail, the Gestapo coming to us in the maybe 4 a.m., 5 a.m., knocking on our door, rousing the household, and taking my father away without saying anything about what was happening or why it was happening. They were polite. They weren't obstreperous in any way. But there he was. He was there, and then he wasn't there. And then I remember within weeks, we were warned by a friend who had insider knowledge that bad things were about to happen, and we were told to drop everything and immediately run to the Polish embassy. We were Polish citizens, and we could seek refuge there, which we did. Now, those happenings and the day I spent in the Polish embassy grounds, running around playing tag with friends while Kristallnacht was being carried out beyond the high iron fence, that remains to me very vividly, very clearly. I had a playmate in Germany who's, I'd never forgotten him, but I had forgotten his name. But when I was reminded of it by a phone call from a cousin of my playmate in 2005, I remembered vividly him and our experiences, and one in particular. He and his father roomed with a Jewish family. There was no mother on the scene. The parents had apparently been divorced. I don't know whether I understood divorce at that time or not, but there was no mother. We were playing in his apartment one afternoon when the family told us to shush because the master of the household was being returned from a concentration camp. And as I sit here and I look at you, I see him. I see him being carried through the door down a long, dark hallway. And he was being sort of helped on either side by a male relative. Now, that's an image that I've always remembered and I've never forgotten.
When you were reunited with your father?
Yes.
I assume you have a million questions. And how much did he provide? Answers to those questions.
I didn't have the questions that I would have had as a teenager.
Right.
I was just very glad to see him. He was also very depressed. But he did tell two stories, or at least I remember two stories that he told. One involved, after he was arrested, my mother sent my sister down to the police station to see what she could find out. And she saw a mass of men gathered there, and a policeman would not tell her any more than the Gestapo officers what it was about. But the policeman did tell her, or suggested to her, that she go home and pack a small valise with a change of clothing for my father. She did that, came back swiftly, and managed to hand him the valise as he was being taken away in a truck as it was moving. In that valise, my mother packed a large bread at the last second. During his 3-day sojourn in a train from Germany to Poland, before the Poles decided to let his train through, one of a few that they did let through with their Polish nationals that were being deported by the Nazis, he used that bread to feed himself and his comrades that he had become acquainted with on the train ride. The other anecdote that I remember was while he was on that train ride, he was lying on the floor and the German soldier or SS man or whoever he was striding above the prone prisoners, deportees, and he looked up and he saw that on the belt buckle of the soldier was emblazoned the slogan, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And my father always remembered that. And I have always remembered that.
When you came to this country, it seems in reading the book that it was as you grew and even in high school, you mentioned the fur business. You knew very early that you wanted to be a journalist. That was something that you wanted in your life.
Yes. What I determined in my own mind was that, one, I didn't want to be a furrier. Two, I didn't want to be a businessman. Three, my mother wanted me to be a dentist, but in probably the most humanitarian gesture in my whole entire life, I didn't become a dentist and spared insufferable pain for so many people. And along the way, I decided that public service would be something that I would be interested in, and very quickly focused that as being journalism.
And not only journalism, but you knew that you wanted to work for the Herald Tribune. That was the goal.
Yes, indeed, because in high school, I went to Stuyvesant High School in New York City. And as part of our routine, they told us we had to subscribe to a daily New York newspaper that would be delivered to our desk. Overwhelmingly, the sentiment in left liberal Stuyvesant was the New York Times, the faculty and everybody. And just that got my dander up. And I said, well, I'll take the Herald Tribune. And I began to read the Herald Tribune in high school, and I loved it. I loved every bit of it. And so when it came time to find a job after high school and before college, I wanted it to be a job in journalism. And I knew where the Herald Tribune was because I had seen its building facade earlier on.
And you started in the shipping room, and of course you're interrupted by college, by the war.
Yes.
But through this time, it was still in you that you wanted to detail and to be ultimately a reporter.
Yes. All during college, I kept returning during the summers to work at the Herald Tribune. In the shipping room. After I graduated, I began to work in the newsroom before I was drafted. And then when I went to Korea, I wound up, because of my background and the fact that I was a clerk typist, that meant I knew how to type, which in the Army is a very rare and desired skill. So they put me into the military history section of a higher headquarters, where the work product was a command report. Pretty soon, I wasn't just typing it. I wheedled myself into the business of writing it.
And after the Korean War, then you started to move up the ladder that I think we even have a nostalgia for of the newspaperman who starts in the shipping room and moves his way up.
Well, most of them started as a copy boy.
A copy boy, right.
But I wasn't fortunate enough to have that. Not that I do not cherish my shipping clerk experience. I do, and I mean that genuinely. But I did want to be that, yes.
At the point where your training, your experiences, your college education at Syracuse University, and then ultimately the early job in journalism, when did you realize that it was all starting to work into a place where you were, that this would be your path, number one, but two, that you were good and confident at what you were doing?
Well, I'll tell you, the early days were very hard because my first job out of, after I was separated from the Army, the only job I could get at the Herald Tribune was to type stencils, cut stencils. And that also was a tedious job. But I did it because it was a job. But I also began to volunteer myself to help the editors of the Herald Tribune News Service edit the copy that they were preparing to disseminate over their wire to clients. So they saw a man with a strong back and a weak mind, and they let me edit this copy. And I knew I was good at it. And I could see it, and they could see I was good at it. But it was a long time. But finally, promotions occurred, and there was a vacancy at the bottom part of the ladder, and I was recognized enough by whatever I had demonstrated over these many years now as a hard worker, as a conscientious worker, that I could do the job. and they gave it to me. And I never had any question whatsoever that, one, I wanted to do this, and two, that I was good at it.
And with that comes not a lot more money, but a little bit more money. And
you surely just.
A little tiny raise, but it gives you enough confidence to keep going.
Yes, our expectations then were more modest than later generations. I did work as a wire filer, and I think it was a couple of years later that I took over running. I became the managing editor of the wire service. So obviously, my superiors thought I was a good worker. And I mean, I had this accreditation as I went along.
And as you said, the early years were certainly very, very tough. But when you look back on it, and certainly I think the reader gets this idea that you were successful, and with that, your rise came quite quickly to be editor, and then even with your position at the Washington Post.
There came a time when I was invited to join the paper itself rather than the news service.
Right.
So I left the news service behind me, and I became the head of the first cable editor and then foreign editor for a admittedly small foreign staff, but with pretensions, with ambitions, whose chief competitor was the New York Times. So that really was, in a way, a very splendid position to be in. And it really extracted out of whatever there was in you, it took out, because it took every bit of that with modest resources to do the kind of job that was called for if we were ever going to keep our nose above water. Eventually, we did not keep our nose above water. And at that time, I joined the Washington Post, taking a step backward now from foreign editor to night foreign editor. And I did that for a little bit when Ben Bradley, the executive editor, decided to make a shift that promoted my boss, the foreign editor, to assistant managing editor and promoted me to foreign editor. Well, by this time, I'm very well accepted there, having been given assignments outside of the foreign field to oversee the flow of copy on election night and so forth, which in the day of hot type was no small feat for any newspaper. So my passport had been stamped several times.
Obviously, you write in the book about Watergate and that story. And one of the things I found fascinating was your relationship with Ben Bradley, who, of course, is this incredible figure in journalism, and the challenges that you have. And I can't come away from reading this and your take on it, and of course having read his take on it, you know, that's almost the way it has to be, doesn't it? Of these tensions and these challenges to get it right and to make it good.
Absolutely, you nailed it. That is just part of the dynamics of a newspaper operation. I don't think it's any different today. If all the equipment has changed, the personal relationships and that are still the same. And while the challenge at the Herald Tribune had been to keep the paper alive, the challenge at the Washington Post, for which I and many others were hired, was to take a mediocre paper and make it something very much better. And that's what Ben Bradley did. If we admire Ben Bradley today, it is because what he did then. And he didn't do it alone, of course. He did it with Catherine Graham. If he didn't have Catherine Graham, the publisher, backing him and funding him, he couldn't have done it. The genius, the greatness of this thing is that they each recognized the other, the strength that each brought to the table, and they had this mutually productive relationship which took the Post in a few short years from that mediocrity to first-class status.
And at what point did you start to realize that in your role as editor, that this was something that would help a news operation, and especially when you're dealing with two young reporters that are on a huge story like Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein?
Well, it was a story that grew. at the beginning was a very big story for the Metro desk, because we didn't get stories of that magnitude that often, especially with national political implications.
Right.
So that was number one. That sustained us. But, and I knew this was a big story for us. And so I had learned through my years as an editor that if you have a big story, you throw a lot of resources into it. And that produces a greater success more quickly. And we were doing this when 2 weeks into the story, Woodward and Bernstein were already writing dual byline stories. I had lunch with the police chief of Washington, D.C. We were friendly because I covered his operations, and he was a really very intelligent and reformist police chief. And we discussed the resignation of John Mitchell, who had just stepped down as the director of the committee to reelect the president. Now, this was in the middle of a campaign, and this was the organization that was leading the campaign of Richard Nixon. And Mitchell, hard-nosed John Mitchell, said he was leaving in order to take care of his wife, unfortunately a public alcoholic, as we all know. And Chief Wilson and I thought this over, and we agreed that John Mitchell, a man of his character and his persuasion, would not have given up that job at that time for those reasons. And I came back and I shared my opinion with Woodward, and he totally agreed. But from that time, in my mind, which is what you're asking, I knew this was really serious canasta. We really had to be on top of our game, because with his resignation, this was reaching very high into the Nixon hierarchy.
It seems that one of the largest things that you have to deal with is this balance of the cynical journalist who thinks that, okay, maybe this is what happened and probably what happened, and then ultimately proving it and getting it right to be what this is indeed the story. How hard is that balance of having the tail wag the dog and not have that happen?
Well, what's hard is the uncertainty. You don't know. You know, you're dealing with bits and pieces, and you're never really quite sure, and you're taking all the steps to try to make sure, and you search your mind what those steps might be and what questions you have to ask. But what I knew was that the future of the Washington Post depended on it, and not only the Washington Post, my future depended on it. And I had to be, I was always trying to make sure that our stuff was right, but this was really highly loaded material, and we needed to be correct because we had arrayed against us the forces of the federal government, which were considerable, and a regime that was evidently disposed to make use of those resources, those powers.
Harry Rosenfeld's new book is From Kristallnacht to Watergate. It is published by Excelsior Editions. We will continue our conversation with Harry Rosenfeld and talk about Watergate and much more on next week's book show. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this and find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.